Hello, I'm Susan Glasser, the editor of Politico, and I'm delighted to be guest hosting this week's edition of the Politico 2016 Nerdcast, where we get together our brightest minds here in the newsroom at Politico and talk geeky stuff, like what numbers really matter this week in the campaign. Okay, so first of all, we're going to talk about $448 million versus $263 million. Ken Vogel will explain more what that means, but the bottom line is quite simply this. Hillary Clinton's fundraising advantage over Donald Trump is much, much bigger than you think. Donald Trump may be the billionaire in the race, but the structural advantage is all Democratic this time around. Here's another set of numbers to consider, and this comes from Eli Stokols, our lead beat reporter on the Trump campaign. 9 and 90. 9 is the number of rapid response emails that came boom, boom, boom out of the Donald Trump communication shop in the midst of Hillary Clinton's 90-minute speech attacking Donald Trump this week. Why does it matter? Because we're desperately, absolutely looking for evidence, any sign of evidence that Donald Trump is starting to look, well, a bit more presidential, especially after his big campaign shakeup this week where he fired his campaign manager. Charlie Matishin offers us two numbers that I find particularly illuminating, 7,116 versus zero. 7,000 is the number of campaign ads that Hillary Clinton has been barraging the key battleground states with. Donald Trump has run zero ads so far. Does it matter? We're going to talk about it. And finally, Scott Bland, our expert on all things House and Senate race this year, comes to us with the number one. One is the only Senate candidate in the country who's actually had the courage to appear in public with one of the major party nominees. And we'll talk about it as we get into this week's edition of the Politico 2016 Nerdcast. I'm delighted to be here today with Ken Vogel, our chief investigative correspondent.
That's me. Thank you.
Eli Stokols, one of our senior political reporters.
And also, like Ken, a big fan of kale.
You know,
big kale.
Charlie Matishin, our senior politics editor and geek in chief.
Wow. Hi, Susan.
Well, thank you guys so much. This has been another week for the record books. And I think what it really has probably reinforced for all of us journalists here at Politico is there's not going to be any down weeks in campaign 2016, right? There's no quiet times. This Monday morning opened up bright and early with Donald Trump shaking up his campaign, Hillary Clinton climbing right on board with basically her pivot to the general election. And I think it's very revealing, some of the stuff we've seen this week. But I want to start first with Ken and this question of just what are we supposed to make of this troubled, contentious, infighting Donald Trump campaign? Does it matter what really happened and went on behind the scenes in this chaos and firing your campaign manager after, by the way, having a huge victory and surprising everybody and knocking out 16 other candidates to get the Republican nomination? Why do you fire the guy?
Yeah, I think the writing was on the wall for Corey Lewandowski for a while. I mean, he had been sparring with Paul Manafort, the guy was brought in to kind of right the ship and professionalize the Trump campaign. At that point, Corey Lewandowski actually told people that he was thinking of quitting at that point because he felt so marginalized. But instead of doing that, he dug in and really deployed what we call a no holds barred style of infighting that's seldom seen in presidential politics, and utilized his loyalty, the loyalty that he had of among the small group of folks, the skeleton staff who he brought in. And also his unusually close relationship with Trump, which he sought to make even closer. During plane rides, Corey Lewandowski was so paranoid about anyone else getting close to Trump and getting in his ear and giving Trump conflicting advice from what Corey was giving him or belittling Corey to Trump, that he would make sure he was sitting next to Trump at all times. And if he had to go to the bathroom, he would make sure that Hope Hicks, the campaign spokeswoman who was a close ally of Corey's, would come in and swap out and sit next to Trump to guard Trump against anyone talking trash on Corey. That said, it kind of got tiring for Corey, and he grew, according to some of the folks who I talked to who are, you know, sympathetic to Corey, Corey grew a little bit reckless in his efforts to hold on to power, even going after, seeking to undermine Trump's own kids, who he saw as a threat. So when it actually happened, and it's important to note here that contrary to some of the media reports, that it happened because the kids really engineered it, and the Don Trump Jr. actually executed, no pun intended, executed the firing without Trump being present, our sources told us. Just show how much more power the kids have gained in the campaign, how Corey was already sort of marginalized, and I think also show the degree of infighting. As to whether it matters, I think it does matter. You cannot overstate the amount of time and energy that this campaign spent on infighting. I mean, Eli, me, Ben Schreckinger, the folks who covered this campaign, we would sit back and marvel. How do they have so much time to be either feeding negative stories on each other to the press or engaging in these efforts to undermine each other? Don't they have a campaign to run? It was like all that they were doing. And so with him out of the picture, I think it does potentially minimize the infighting, although the kids are also their own sort of faction. So there might be some left over there.
Well, it's interesting. You bring up this question of Corey's substantive role in the campaign, right? And he is identified not only with this crazy infighting, but basically the let Trump be Trump faction. And that's the big question right now, Eli, isn't it? As you think about covering the campaign, what does it mean, this fantasy idea that Donald Trump is somehow going to be different? Are there any signs that that's really taking place, number one? Number two, what have you learned in covering the campaign about Donald Trump as the guy running the operation? I think Ken's story is very revealing and very interesting about how the firing went down. Remember, Donald Trump is the guy who was famous on TV, right, for saying, "You're fired." He's the decider. He's the boss. Well, how come he had to have his kid do the firing when a painful decision was required?
Well, if there's not a TV camera in a pretend boardroom, maybe he's less interested in being that person. I mean, when Rick Wiley was hired, Donald Trump never met the guy. When he was fired, Donald Trump didn't do it. I mean, this is a guy who sort of likes to, you just have to go back to sort of TV, but you can see in the campaign too, when there's cameras there, he walks in, he waves, he wants to look like he's in control, but it's a handshake, it's a how are things going, okay, great, and move on. It's very surface level, and you can see, yes, the kids have been empowered in this campaign and are taking on a larger role, but Donald Trump sort of is the figurehead here. And Donald Trump is sort of driving his own messaging based on what he thinks. But in terms of personnel and how to build out a campaign and what to do, Donald Trump doesn't really have a clue. Donald Trump doesn't understand what you need in terms of an organization or data. Donald Trump just thought for a long time that, well, I did it my way. I fired off some tweets. I did a lot of interviews. I drowned everybody else out in the media. And I won. So I'll just keep doing it. And part of the problem was that Corey Lewandowski was really enabling that thinking. Corey's power play really was to not only be close to Trump, but to sort of validate every thought and idea that Donald Trump had, whether it was, let's start banning journalism outlets. Let's start just saying this news organization can't. I mean, that was something that if Manafort had been in charge, he would have said probably, "You can't do that, boss." But with Lewandowski, he said, "Great idea, let's do it." And you can play that. There are a lot of iterations of that where I think Corey was validating Trump's, the id part of Trump and allowing him to sort of just go with his sort of most impulsive thoughts and behaviors and tweets. And I think that's where eventually the kids had to sort of come in and impress on their father, where Reince Priebus had to start making a case like, "This is not how you do it. It's general election time now." And I think that they all came to sort of view Corey as sort of the clog in the drain in terms of Donald, moving and changing and becoming a little bit more general election.
So you brought some numbers to the table here that seem relevant. Is there a change or isn't there a change?
Well, the idea that the 70-year-old man is suddenly going to change, shapeshift, shed his skin, whatever, become a different person, run on different ideas, is sort of ludicrous. So the idea of a new Trump is kind of a joke. But you did notice immediately the clog in the drain. When you remove the clog, here's what happens. Over the last ever since Corey was fired, basically, this week, we've gotten 20 emails from the Trump communications department, everything from rapid response. 9 of them came in like the 90-minute period when Hillary Clinton was giving her speech on Tuesday, and they were all these sort of, you know, taking apart her speech, or here are a bunch of reference points, or here's some data undercutting what she was saying. We never saw that before. It was
I'd like to point out that I'm still not receiving those emails. So perhaps there is some reluctance to fully embrace and engage with the free press still that lingers. And if anyone from the Trump campaign is listening to this podcast right now, I would like to personally make the case again to be added to the press list.
Okay, but Charlie, I want to bring you in here for some historical perspective. It really is unusual, isn't it, for a campaign to actually fire its campaign manager after winning in the way that Trump's campaign has, right?
Certainly this late in the campaign. I mean, you've seen it before. You see changes at the top. Ronald Reagan did it in 1980, and things worked out pretty well for him. But generally, things even worked out in John McCain's case in 2008. But again, those firings happened so far before the general election that a campaign was able to sort of right itself and change the direction, the messaging, and to do it now, so close to the general election, so close to the convention, with so many other variables in the air, really, I think, tells you a lot about the way the campaign is just doing this seat of the pants at a time when everyone in politics understands that it's just too big of an endeavor to run it by the seat of your pants.
But it's also, you know, Paul Manafort was brought in months ago. And so for a while, I mean, as an equal to Lewandowski, or as Manafort said at the time, you know, the only person I answer to is the boss. He made it clear at the beginning that he was not coming in beneath the campaign manager, Corey Lewandowski. And obviously we saw the infighting until Corey's dismissal. But, you know, when Roger Stone was unceremoniously kicked off the campaign or kicked out of the inner circle earlier, what did he do? He went right on TV and started singing Trump's praises, and he's been doing it ever since and is still one of the very few touch points there is on Trump, even though he's technically outside of Trump Tower, outside of the campaign. Corey Lewandowski shows up this week at this New York Republican Party fundraiser that they did the day after he got fired. Hope Hicks shows up along with a few other campaign folks, and Corey is sitting there for 45 minutes opining on the greatness of Donald Trump, even though he just got fired. And so I think, you know, Corey now becomes kind of a liaison to the media, maybe a more friendly one, and definitely a surrogate for Trump who will be used over the next couple months. So in terms of like taking apart the campaign and starting from scratch, I would just say they have a guy in place who's sort of been assuming the responsibilities of running the campaign for a while.
Two things.
And Lewandowski still sticks around.
I mean, Roger, you think so? You think Corey sticks around?
Not an official role, but I mean, I think he's going to. We're going to be talking about him and talking to him over the next several months.
Here's the Roger Stone comparison that I think is extremely worrisome for the campaign. You talk about, you're right, publicly, Roger Stone got the boot. He said nice things about Trump, continued to be a sort of surrogate for him. But what he did privately was dedicate himself to undermining Corey Lewandowski.
Right.
He had plants in the campaign who were farming out information to the press about Corey Lewandowski. If Corey turns around and does that to Paul Manafort, you could see a potentially disastrous result. Now, as far as whether the campaign will change, I think there was a chicken or the egg thing with Corey. I mean, you're right. Corey was, in fact, validating Trump's instincts, some of his most self-destructive and offensive instincts. That said, the reason why Trump allowed him to stick around so long and let him be so close and became so loyal to him, where he refused to fire him even after his kids urged him to for months and months, was that he liked having those instincts validated. So what happens when Paul Manafort comes in and says, no, boss, don't say that the judge in the Trump University case is biased against you because he's of Mexican heritage. That's a stupid decision. Everyone recognizes a stupid decision. Trump doesn't want to hear that. And even if you tell him that, he's probably not going to listen, and it may undermine your ability or someone's ability to be able to speak to him directly.
Yeah, Corey totally used that as a wedge, and it worked well for him for a while, saying, you know, boss, these other people telling you to do something different, they don't believe in you.
But listen,
I do.
We've been sucked into the soap opera that is the Trump campaign. Listen to our conversation even, which is all about this personality conflict that, you know, it's the reality show and we're now the participants in it. So Ken, I'm going to go back to the structure of politics. This is the Nerdcast here. What are the consequences of having a dysfunctional, infighting, soap opera of a campaign. We've all seen really, really bad campaigns that won. We've all seen really, really well-run campaigns that lost. Now, this week, some numbers came out, numbers that had, you know, DC campaign finance wonks freaking out. Donald Trump had only $1.3 million cash on hand, money in the bank for his campaign. Washington went crazy. My guess is the rest of the world probably didn't register this important news. You brought some numbers to share with us about money and the kind of stuff that campaign operatives take really seriously, even if they don't tune in to the personality dynamic type fighting that we're talking about.
The numerical comparison that everyone was seizing on this week after the FEC reports came out was the disparity in cash on hand between the Trump campaign and the Clinton campaign. Trump had $1.3 million in the bank at the end of last month compared to Hillary Clinton's $42.5 million. That's a huge gulf, but and it's a problem. But I don't think it really tells the story of just how deep Trump's problems are financially. So what I did was I added up the amount raised by the campaigns, by their primary super PACs, and by their national party committees. And I found that the Hillary Clinton forces, that's Hillary Clinton, Priorities USA, which is one of her super PACs, American Bridge was another super PAC, and the DNC added up to $448 million. On the flip side of the ledger, Trump's forces, $263 million. That's the Trump campaign, a pair of sort of fledgling super PACs, and the RNC. And actually, that gulf is probably even wider than I've just ticked off the $448 million to the $263 million, because that's assuming that one of these Trump super PACs that just started that hasn't reported any money, but that has told people that it has $32 million in pledges. That's assuming that's real. I don't necessarily know that it is. And the reason why, this is such a problem, is that Trump really just has not dedicated any time to build any time, energy, effort, or money to building the type of campaign finance infrastructure that will be able to continually bring in money, not just bring in money at a good clip, but bring in money necessary to catch up to Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton, on the flip side, has been working for years. I mean, you could say 8 years going back to 2008. You could say 30 years going back to her husband's first presidential run, or the preparations for it, to build this network of major donors who suddenly, in this presidential election cycle, more than any other, have been empowered to write these huge checks to support her campaign through super PACs. And that is something that is going to just continue.
Well, that's what I want to get at. Charlie, why does it matter? Donald Trump likes to talk about numbers, but not this kind of numbers. He never talks about money except to say he's very, very rich and to inflate his bottom line. You brought us some numbers that suggest why Hillary Clinton's financial advantage matters.
Well, what's amazing, in addition to the campaign kitties that both candidates have, is that not only are we looking at the most lopsided fundraising start to a presidential election in the modern campaign finance era, we're also looking at an enormous disparity in terms of the number of ads that the campaigns are running. So, for example, between May 8th and June 18th, Hillary Clinton's campaign aired 7,116 TV spots on broadcast and national cable TV. By contrast, the Donald Trump campaign aired exactly zero. Now, the Clinton numbers don't even include the roughly 12,000 spots that were run by Priorities USA Action, which is the main super PAC backing Clinton. And so what you're talking about here is almost like a marathon. I mean, think about a 26.2-mile marathon. Hillary Clinton is starting at the 10-mile mark, while Donald Trump is at the starting line himself. So she's got an enormous advantage here. And now I think you could probably argue that, you know, TV's losing its power and its ability to move voters in this era. It's really tough to break through all the noise. And there are lots of forces diverting voters' attention. But it's not like he is pouring resources into any sector of the campaign. It's not like that TV money that's not being spent is going toward a ground game or big data. I mean, there is no analytics that is going to save him. There's nothing going on otherwise. And so here Hillary Clinton is blanketing the swing state landscape, because that's where all these ads are running, and getting out her message, and it's crickets on the Republican
side. Okay, so
I would just say, I mean, I think what Charlie's right, I mean, they had nothing in the primary, but they had confidence that what they did worked. They had a data program that was basically Eventbrite. People would sign up and go to their events, and they would get their information, email address that way. And that worked. And I think there's just the Trump campaign had overconfidence. Investors, the donor class, had no confidence. And that's why they haven't donated, because they haven't seen a campaign that was really serious and showing them the things that they usually see in campaigns. They didn't get the touches. Donald Trump, like you said, you know, doesn't like to ask other people for money. He likes to talk about how much he has. So it's sort of not natural for him to be dialing for dollars and doing the outreach and sucking up to these donors like they're used to having happen with other candidates. And, you know, in terms of not inspiring confidence, the last month, his performance, the bad story after bad story after bad story, I mean, it just has snowballed to a point where people are just, you know, why would there be any investor confidence in donor circles that putting money into Donald Trump's campaign is going to be a good investment in the end?
Right.
And I think it's all sort of, you know, now it's a chicken or egg thing, because you hear stories like 1.3, 42.5, huge disparity. And it just makes it harder. Trump comes out and says, well, I'll just self-finance. And that undercuts the urgency, because there's this urgency that we need to catch up. And he's like, ah, no, I got it. It'll be fine. So there's just, it just keeps getting compounded, this money problem.
Okay, so we are going to wrap up this big first segment of all the stuff that's happened this week with sort of a question around this moment in the campaign. We have just a few weeks until the conventions. Hillary Clinton is basically running on Barack Obama's theory of the case, which is to say, you've got to use this period of time to define your opponent. Forget about what happens late in the going. This is really the moment. That's why we've seen these major speeches from Hillary Clinton this week, and also from Donald Trump attacking Hillary Clinton on all the records of Clinton scandal and the like. So I want to ask each of you very quickly, how's that war going to define the other guy? That's really what it comes down to this week. And Charlie, in addition to that, what is in all of those ads? Is this money well spent? What do you think?
Well, the ads that came out after the news of the first big tranche of Clinton ads in this swing states were of two varieties. One of them was had some footage of Hillary Clinton looking presidential, but it also had a lot of negative material on Donald Trump, had lots of unfavorable clips of him, grainy footage of him saying really outrageous things. But it also had two other spots, more soft focus biography spots with tinkling piano music and pictures of her throughout her life. And, you know, when you look at them, they were okay. But to me, they didn't really jump off the page. They didn't really advance her argument that much. In fact, you know, in some ways, I thought the message was really weak and fell far short of what she's going to need to do to sort of change her own numbers, because one of the tagline on one of them was, for Hillary, it's always been about the kids. Well, to me, like if you looked at a Simpsons parody of a campaign ad, for Mayor Quimby, it's always been about the children. You know, I mean, that is not really going to move the dial.
Teach them well and let them lead the way. Ken, what do you think? The war to define the other guy, how's it going this week?
You know, I've been continually surprised by the comparisons that you hear from top Democrats to the success that Obama had defining Mitt Romney at this stage in 2012. And they basically are trying to, some of them are trying to use that same blueprint to define Donald Trump. And they're literally using like some of the same words, that he is a greedy vulture capitalist who doesn't care about workers, and he's so wealthy he's out of touch. And to me, Trump has kind of inoculated himself from that precise type of criticism by bragging about how rich he is and how shrewd he is of making deals. So I don't necessarily think that that works. I do think that some of the ads that just use his words, suggesting that he is either misogynist or racist or xenophobic, I think that some of that sort of sinks in. And Hillary Clinton's most effective moment, I think, of the whole campaign came when she gave that speech where she was just quoting Donald Trump. And I thought that really worked. You're seeing some of that, but I think Democrats have to be wary of falling into this trap of using the Romney playbook.
Well,
and I think, you know, Hillary's speeches have been fairly effective because Donald Trump at the same time wasn't capable of a response. And what he was doing was playing right into her hands as defining himself in the same way, with all the comments about the judge and then the very self-congratulatory response to the Orlando terror attack. These were bad moments for his campaign where she could basically stand up on a stage and just point and say, see? See what I'm talking about? This week, finally, you know, you have Corey Lewandowski fired. You have a speech on Wednesday that is for Trump, who granted has a pretty low bar when it comes to giving a speech and staying on message, that was on message for Trump. It was somebody, an operative told me that was surreal watching Donald Trump give a speech that was almost like a speech you'd expect from a presidential candidate. He was focused for an hour on attacking Hillary Clinton. And there were lines in there. I mean, some of it sort of was undercut by embellishments and inaccuracies and you know, overstatements. But there were things in there. When he took her slogan and said, I'm with her, and then he said, no, I'm with you, and he repurposed her slogan. Now the Trump campaign is selling a T-shirt with Trump saying, I'm with you. I mean, this is at least something that people can now hang their hat on, saying, okay, he's starting to get it. He's starting to pivot and actually focus on Hillary and maybe even land some punches. And that obviously is what he's got to do.
We have joining us now Scott Bland as well, who is Politico's chief guru on all things House and Senate races this year. And really, what an incredible subject that is turning out to be, Scott. The Donald Trump effect, how it's going to play down ballot. What level of panic is there among Republicans running for the Senate this year, running for the House? You brought us a number to consider.
Yeah, the number I brought this week is one, and that's the number of Senate nominees, major party Senate nominees, who have appeared with either Clinton or Trump in their many visits on their swing state tours in the 2 weeks since the primaries ended in California. And that's Ted Strickland, the Democratic nominee in Ohio, who appeared with Hillary Clinton at her rally in Columbus earlier this week. But before that, Donald Trump went on a big swing of rallies and fundraising tours through four states that have major Senate contests coming up. He was in New Hampshire, North Carolina, Arizona, and then Nevada over the course of the last week. And the only Republican Senate candidate to appear in public at one of his rallies was John McCain's Tea Party primary challenger, Kelly Ward, who is currently getting savaged by McCain's super PAC ads, painting her as a chemtrails conspiracy theorist and, you know, kind of some wacky national security votes in the state legislature. She was the only one. Everyone, and it's not just that they didn't show up to the rallies, because some Democrats haven't shown up to Clinton rallies either. Clinton was in North Carolina this week, and neither Roy Cooper, who's running for governor, or Deborah Ross, who's running for Senate, who no one knows, who could really would probably like to borrow a crowd at this point. She didn't show up either. But they at least acknowledged that Clinton was in their state. They said, oh, you know, we had other events. This was scheduled too late. We're going to be there next time. The Republicans aren't even acknowledging the fact that Trump is coming to their state. McCain spent the day that that Trump was in Phoenix. He was 20 miles down the road at the Swaggies, which are like a local Chamber of Commerce awards dinner that, according to his office, he'd had on the books for months. And, you know, there's no way, you know, you can't just cancel an event. And this is going to repeat itself over and over and over.
And this is a consequence of having the two most unpopular major party nominees basically ever in recent history. Is that right?
Yeah, I think I was looking at the Huffington Post polling averages this morning, and I think Trump is hovering around 60% unfavorable. Clinton's at 54 unfavorable, which is not good, but it's better. It's better than Trump's. I think we talked about last week, it's going to be interesting to see in the swing states if that moves at all, given that she's putting all this money into positive advertising right now, or whether or not that's just a totally kind of hard and fast facet of the landscape at this point, like both of them being so unpopular. But I think, you know, you can see it in neither party is, you know, their Senate people aren't totally embracing. I think the Democrats are doing it more. But on the flip side, the Republicans are taking every opportunity to hit Democratic candidates like Ted Strickland in Ohio for tying themselves to Clinton.
Charlie, you've watched this for many years. What does it matter that you're in a national election year? How much can an unpopular nominee like Trump blow a Senate race for a Republican Senate candidate who might otherwise have a pretty good shot?
Well, you see it has an enormous impact in the close races, and you've seen that in recent Senate cycles going back at least for a decade, where the presidential race has a you know, a slight 1 or 2 point effect on lots of these races. And I think we're beginning to see it, especially in a place like Pennsylvania, which is a key swing state, has a key Senate race. And I thought it was really revealing the news this week that there is a freshman congressman there from a district in the Philadelphia suburbs and exurbs that was Romney carried narrowly, was a Barack Obama district in 2008. He resigned from his role as a convention delegate. So that makes him the second House member in Pennsylvania to say they're not going to the convention. And the reason you do that, if you're this congressman, his name's Representative Ryan Costello, and he gave, of course, the classic political, I want to spend more time with my family, I want to spend time in the district, which is always the dead giveaway, those two. But what you see from that is he is scared of the blowback and can't afford to. It is the members in lockdown conservative districts that can afford to go to the convention. The blowback won't hurt them. If it's really bad, they'll still squeak it through. But when you're on the margin, like a freshman from an exurban district where you're not sure exactly how Trump is going to play, you can't take that chance. And that's why he went so far as to resign his delegate position and not go to Cleveland.
Although, or like Mark Kirk. Who actually rescinded his Mark Kirk rescinded his endorsement of Donald Trump, you know, facing a tough re-election fight in Illinois, in Ohio. Rob Portman under pressure. You talk about Ted Strickland and they're trying to link Ted Strickland to Hillary. Rob Portman is under pressure to rescind his endorsement. Ron Johnson in Wisconsin, another swing state where he's up for in a tough re-election fight, is trying to draw the distinction between supporting, saying he'll support Donald Trump, and saying he'll endorse Donald Trump. So you see already him being an albatross in a way that I just don't think Hillary Clinton is.
Here's the thing. I think the Costello example that Charlie just brought up is fascinating because this is the Nerdcast, and so this morning I was you know, going through some old FEC filings before I came into work.
You do that every morning. Come
and,
on.
And I was looking at this district. This is one of those, and Democratic operatives looking at these down ballot races are starting to see a little bit of separation going on between what's happening in really more blue collar areas where Trump is kind of scaring them a little bit with how he's doing in their polling, and places with more college educated voters where he's really hurting at this point. And these Philadelphia collar county districts like Costello's are one of those. But Costello's Democratic opponent had $16,000 in the bank. That's it. In April. You can't run a campaign on that in one of the most expensive media markets in the country. And you know, no amount of super PAC spending can't pay a single staffer off $16,000. I'm sure he's raised some money since he won the primary, but there are the House landscape especially is dotted with districts like this where maybe Romney won by a few points or even a lot where Obama carried it but are now represented by a Republican member of Congress where the Democratic challengers just don't really have any juice.
Okay, so I want to pull this back for our final lightning round here to the question that this conversation is highlighting, which is really Donald Trump still has problems with the Republican base. He's got anxious Senate candidates in key districts in key states around the country who aren't sure about endorsing him, who are even rescinding their endorsements. He's got jittery donors who aren't sure they want to give money to a potentially losing cause. Ken has a great story out this morning pointing out that, you know, Republican officials are even quietly assuring those jittery Republican donors, well, how about you give to the party and we'll find a way to make sure that it doesn't get too much going to the presidential campaign's benefit. How much does Donald Trump still have a problem? Is he still trying to lock down his Republican base? What do you guys make of these last-ditch, you know, sort of fated to die, never Trump efforts looking towards the Republican convention in July? Lightning round. Eli, you get to go first.
Well, I think in terms of the convention, he has not tamped down the chatter about you know, the nuclear option and the Rules Committee and unbinding the delegates. And so that's something you're going to continue to hear about because he's limping into this convention. And we have myriad examples this week of how not unified the Republican Party is. Marco Rubio deciding, hey, I am going to run for Senate. Well, Donald Trump's trailing by almost double digits in Florida. So what did he do? He announced and went out of his way to criticize the presumptive nominee of his party. Not a new look for Marco Rubio, but, you know, they're all trying to walk that tightrope. You've got Michigan, a state that Trump is targeting, where the governor says, I'm not endorsing you. You've got Colorado, another swing state, where the most vulnerable congressman, Mike Kaufman, in a district that was redrawn a couple of years ago, forced him to learn Spanish because the district got so Hispanic. There's no way in hell he's going to endorse Donald Trump. And so you have example after example after example in every swing state around the country of people. Yeah, there are some districts where it makes sense to sort of align yourself with Trump. But for the most part, there are probably more examples of Republicans making that calculation that it's probably best to keep your distance. You may have to say, yeah, I support our nominee, because you're going to keep getting that question until you say that or come up with a clear answer. But example after example of the fact that this party's probably not going to be unified the way we think of a unified party heading into a fall election.
Trump's Republican problem.
I think that realistically, there's not that. I don't think there's anything that can be done at the convention. I mean, it would just risk too much. The guy got more votes than any other Republican primary presidential candidate in a Republican primary. He has support out there among the populace, and they would sit home, or they would revolt, or they would vote for Gary Johnson. They would do anything to retaliate against a Republican Party that was seen as not just ignoring the will of the voters, but actually actively sticking their finger in the eye of the voters. So I don't think that that's a real risk. That said, I do think that the Trump folks are taking it seriously. We had a story this week. We got a readout of a conference call where they were talking about building this huge whip team. They had actually already built this huge whip team and were building a database of all the delegates of the convention. It's one of the few areas where I think the Trump campaign actually has a serious infrastructure, and that's because they do remain concerned about the prospect that it could be snatched away from Trump. The Republican elite do remain very skeptical and wary of getting on the Trump train. And that's what we were talking about, alluding to with the RNC. They want to make sure that if Trump does go south, and, you know, it's early, but the possibility of him totally tanking and it being a lost cause months before the general election is real. And they want to make sure that they're covering their you-know-whats in case he does become not just a lost cause, but really toxic for these down-ballot candidates. So the RNC is gathering resources to potentially direct them down ballot, like we saw in 1996 when Bob Dole sort of emerged as a lost cause, and the RNC shifted the money and the resources and the time and the staff resources away from Dole down ballot to try to save the Senate. I think we could potentially see a repeat of that unless Donald Trump really gets his act together.
Charlie, last word.
I agree with Eli, that it would be a heavy lift to oust him as the nominee right now. But I would say it is not a certainty that Donald Trump is going to be the nominee. Because think about what's out there right now. All that anxiety. There are questions about his money. There are questions about his ground game. There are questions about his organization. There are questions about whether he's ideologically in sync with the party. I mean, it is June. The convention is a month away. And he is meeting with evangelical leaders because he hasn't locked down them either. Now, and think about all the forces driving a challenge to Donald Trump. I mean, there is a conscience play to be made from people that are very straightforward in their opposition to what he stands for and what he might do to the party, and he hasn't assuaged any of their concerns. And also, there is an ambition play. These are the most ambitious people in the world. There is a lane here, whether it's 2020 or 2024, and somebody is going to fill that lane. The best way to do it is to be the white knight who takes on Donald Trump.
A provocative thought to end us with this week. Thank you to everybody for a lot of good number slinging and a lot of good geeking out on 2016. Wow, thanks for a great conversation to everybody, and thank you to joining us on this week's edition of the Politico 2016 Nerdcast. I hope you'll subscribe to us on iTunes, listen to us on SoundCloud, subscribe to us on Stitcher or wherever your favorite podcast app is. We'll look forward to being back with our regular host, Kristen Roberts, next week for the Nerdcast.